Job chapter 32 to chapter 37. Elihu. Number one, his rage. Number two, his rebuke. Number three, his revelation. This fellow was a wonderful man. Everybody who met him, everybody who saw him, everybody who listened to him, agreed. A wonderful man with a wonderful talent and an exceptional smile. If you go out of this room, get the 86 bus and get off at Allerton, there'll be a shop named after him. If you go down into the middle of town, there'll be a street named after him. He was a singer and a dancer, an actor, a trumpet player, and a world record holder. Is there anybody here who does tap dancing? He did a million taps in 23 hours and 45 minutes. He was once asked to contribute to an article. At the time, he had lung cancer. He was to die of lung cancer, though never having smoked a cigarette in his life. The man who wrote to him was a man whose name was Jonathan Gabay, who was writing a book entitled The Meaning of Life. And he asked Roy Castle, "What is the meaning of life to you?" This is what he wrote. "Dear Jonathan, love God and all he has created. And at the end, be able to look back and smile." My sister lived near to where Fiona Castle lived. And Fiona said, when Roy was dying, one day he said, "Darling, can you hear that music?" "What music's that, sweetheart?" "Oh, I think it's the music of heaven." Another time, he said, "Sweetheart, I saw Jesus today. He stood in the doorway and he smiled at me." Roy Castle died in the arms of his wife, in the presence of his family, and with full assurance of faith. I have to admit to you, I was deeply, deeply challenged by that answer, "Love God and all that he has created, and at the end, be able to look back and smile." But what if you can't look back and smile? What if you don't hear music from heaven? What if Jesus doesn't stand in your doorway and speak to you? What if there's pain, nightmares, terror, fear, and silence? What if God appears absent, distant, handcuffed, unconcerned, a spectator beyond the Andromeda galaxy who would love to help us out but just can't? What if you're sitting in a dunghill covered with sores in excruciating pain, physical, mental, emotional, social, psychological, spiritual anguish? What if Instead of having friends around you comforting you, there are people around you criticizing you. Instead of sympathizing with you, sermonizing to you. What if the accusation comes time and time and time again? It's your great sin that has brought your great suffering. What if Eliphaz comes to lecture you? He's a legalist. What if Bildad, the traditionalist, comes to terrify you? What if Zophar, the dogmatist, comes to insult you and add insult to your injury? And what if you are accused of all sorts of things, so much so that you have to answer, no, I'm not a womanizer, no, I'm not an adulterer, no, I'm not a liar, no, I'm not an abuser of power, no, I'm not a materialist, no, I'm not an uncaring, dismissive power seeker who tramples all over the poor and the widow. No, I'm not guilty of secret sins. I am innocent of the charges you are laying at my feet. And what if you're crying out to God? Please, where are you? And is there a mediator? You know, Job amazingly said, though you slay me, I will trust you. Amazingly said, I know that my Redeemer lives. I will stand with him in the last day. In my flesh I shall see God. Amazingly, he says, when he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. By the end of chapter 31 of the book of Job, we read this. The words of Job are ended. At the beginning of chapter 32, so these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. There is silence now. I wonder, speak, Lord, in the silence while I wait on thee. Hush my soul to listen in expectancy. God will come and speak to Job. You must not miss that. But right now, someone else comes to the fore. He's a young man, and he's angry. And his name is Elihu. Look at his rage. He burns with anger. We read, Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job, because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger. Friends, listen. All of you here, all of us here have been angry. It's another thing altogether to burn with anger, don't you think? His mouth is dry. He's trembling. Perhaps his knuckles are white. He's looking fierce. He's shaking inside. He may have good reason to be so in his own mind, but nevertheless, he is in a rage. He's in a rage with Job because he thinks that Job has pleaded innocence when he's not. He's in a rage with Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar because they've not been able to deal with Job. Burning with anger. I'm young in years, you are aged, therefore I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, let days speak and many years teach wisdom. But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand. It's not old who are wise, nor the age who understands what is right. Therefore I say, listen to me. Let me also declare my opinion. Not only is he burning with anger, he's full of words. Look at verse 17. I will also answer with my share. I will also declare my opinion, for I am full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. Elihu, that's an understatement. Six long chapters without a break. 165 verses, 2,165 words. Elihu, your monologue to Job is longer than 10 Old Testament books. Your monologue to Job is the same as or longer than 17 New Testament books. And in chapter 32 alone, he uses the term I 19 times and me and mine 13 times. I have read everything I can get my hand on Elihu, and opinion between commentators is very much divided. Some think he's wise, the others think he's wordy, and others think he's rude. I don't have a monopoly on the truth. You'll have to make up your own mind. But I've read this over and over and over and over and over and over again. Here's a young man who's got a lot to say, who's burning with anger, who can appear rude. He comes out with some absolute gems. But I tell you this, in my life, statements made when you're very angry are not the best. Are they? You know, we should learn to lose our tempers permanently. He's full of words. What's more, he's bursting to speak. Look at verse 19. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery towards any person, for I do not know how to flatter, else my maker would soon take me away. It's a wineskin. If you open it up, it's going to spurt out. I suppose if you took a bottle of champagne and open the top and it pops out and all it comes out, I'm like that. I'm just bursting to speak. He's waited patiently. He's been frustrated. And he will have his say. Number two, we have his rebuke. It can be summarized. Verse 12 of chapter 33, you are not right, I will answer you, for God is greater than man. You're not right, Job. God is greater than man, he's greater than you. You see, he says, the Spirit of God has made me, verse 4, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. Answer me if you can. Say your words in order before me. Take your stand. Behold, I am toward God as you are. I too was pinched off from a piece of clay. Behold, no fear of me need terrify you. My pressure will not be heavy on you. Surely you have spoken in my ears, and I have heard the sound of your words. You say, I am pure, without transgression. I am clean. There is no iniquity in me. Elihu, I give you that you must have listened well to Job and to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, but you did not listen right. Job has never said, I am pure without transgression, I am clean, there is no iniquity in me. In chapter 7 and verse 21, Job was asking God to pardon his iniquity. In chapter 13, verse 26, he was saying to God, don't remember the sins of my youth. Yes, you're right. God is greater than man. Yes, you're right. There's no one who can stand in the holy, awesome presence of one who's of purer eyes than to behold iniquity and cannot look on sin. Yes, you're right. Job is not sinless. But he's innocent of the charges which have been brought against him. But then in this rebuke, Elihu comes out with an absolute gem confirmed in the New Testament. Fundamentally, Job is saying, God is not speaking to me. God is silent. God is absent. God is distant. No, says Elihu. God is not silent. God speaks, verse 14. For God speaks in one way and in two. The man does not perceive it in a dream, in a vision. He brings warnings, verse 16. Or a man is also rebuked, verse 19, with pain on his bed and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. His flesh is so wasted away that it cannot be seen. Incidentally, that's a description of Job. And his bones that were not seen stick out. His soul draws near to the pit and his life to those who bring death. If there be for him an angel, a mediator, one of the thousand to declare to a man what is right for him. And he is merciful to him and says, deliver him from going down into the pit. I have found a ransom. Let his flesh become fresh with youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor. Then man prays to God and he accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy and he restores to man his righteousness. There's a different pitch now. Your great suffering is because of your great sin, said Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Now Elihu says, Job, suffering is not just punitive. It's not just God punishing you. It's corrective. It's God correcting you. It's not just penal. It's something moral. You learn such an awful lot. And God can speak. He can speak in visions. He can speak in dreams. He can give you warnings. And he can speak in pain. Do you remember what C.S. Lewis said? God whispers in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our conscience. He shouts at us in our pains. Pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. How true that is. Friend, you ought to be glad that you have pain. Ask any doctor. Pain will indicate there's something wrong and therefore needs something to be put right. So yes, Elihu comes out with these gems. Suffering's not punitive, it's corrective. God's just correcting you. He's teaching you some moral lessons. He's going to bring you out of this. Because God speaks one way or another, Job. However, I wonder if you come to chapter 34 and verse 34. Because now he's speaking about the wise men, perhaps those surrounding him, perhaps Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Men of understanding will say to me, and the wise man who hears me will say, Job speaks without knowledge, his words are without insight. Would that Job were tried to the end, because he answers like a wicked man. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Look at verse 16 of chapter 35. Job opens his mouth in empty talk. He multiplies words without knowledge. Even if you're quoting others, Elihu, that's hardly comforting, is it? Of course, Elihu doesn't know. Neither does Eliphaz, Bildad, or Zophar. They don't know that there's been a drama in heaven, and God, in the mystery of his sovereignty, has permitted Satan, in his heinous villainy, to inflict suffering of such intensity upon Job. He doesn't also know that God has said, consider my servant Job. There's none like him. But he comes with his rebuke. Some of it a gem. Others of it a goad. Thirdly, we have his revelation. I'm trying to summarize these chapters. It's hard work, I tell you. But essentially, God has revealed himself to me. In fact, Elihu himself says, I'm the mouthpiece of God. That's a bold statement. You do well to listen to me, old man, there on your ash heap. God has revealed himself to me. Chapter 36. Come with me, will you, please? God is mighty. Chapter 36, verse 5. Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. Chapter 36, verse 22. God is exalted in his power. Can you see that? Behold, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has prescribed for him his way? Or who can say, you have done wrong? God is eternal. See that? In chapter 36, verse 26b. Behold, God is great and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable. He's great. And he's eternal. Now he describes God as the creator. Look at verse chapter 36, verse 26. Behold, God is great and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable, for he draws up the drops of water. They distill his mist in rain, which the skies pour down and drops on mankind abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thundering of his pavilion? Behold, he scatters the lightning about him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these he judges people, he gives food in abundance. He covers his hand with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares his presence. The cattle also declare that he rises, and so on it goes. Look at creation around you. God is thundering. God is speaking. He is the majestic creator. Wonderful. Chapter 37, verse 4. After its voice roars, he thunders with his majestic voice. And he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. God is majestic. God is wondrous in his works. Look at verse 14 of chapter 37. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you not know how God lays his command upon them and causes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you not know the balancing of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? This God is wondrous in his works. This God is perfect in his knowledge. Look at chapter 37, verse 22. Out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty, the Almighty. We cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness. He will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. This is wonderful stuff. It's been revealed to me. God is mighty, exalted in power, great and eternal, a great creator, majestic, wondrous in his works, perfect in his knowledge, almighty, abundant in his justice. He's a God to be feared. Now, commentators have rightly said that Elihu is building a bridge unknown to him, which will allow the Almighty himself to come and speak to Job. Elihu, I've struggled with you this week, but I'm glad I'm not the only one. There's been commentators down the ages who've struggled with you. John Piper thinks you're wonderful. Other people think you're terrible. But I like the way you have a big God. And even though I wonder at some of the things you say and the way you say them, you're right. God is great. How great a being, Lord, is thine, which doth all beings keep. Thy knowledge is the only line to sound so vast a deep. Thou art a sea without a shore, a sun without a sphere. Thy time is now and evermore. Thy place is everywhere. My God, how wonderful thou art. Thy majesty, how bright. How beautiful thy mercy seat in depths of burning light. How dread are thine eternal years, O everlasting Lord, by prostrate spirits day and night incessantly adored. But Elihu, we're in the 21st century. We have the New Testament and the whole of Revelation. In fact, the revelation you received was partial. The fullest and greatest and highest display of revelation is in the person of God's own Son. He is the final word. He is the living word. And let me tell you, because of him, all of God's greatness is cradled in his grace. And we don't just come to those who are dying and wounded and hurting and broken and speak of a great God. We speak of a gracious God, a God who became man, a God who was stripped naked. His back was like a plowed field, a crown of thorns pressed into his brow, nails driven into his hands and feet, a spear into his side, who knew what it was to suffer. Remember what C.S. Lewis wrote? Love as hard as nails. Love is nails. Blunt, thick, hammered through. The medial nerves of one who, having made us, knew the thing he had done. Seeing with all that is our cross and his. And Elihu, we're going to sing a song today never sung at Bridge Chapel. Some Christians don't like it. Elihu, they think that whoever wrote this must be a universalist. They're wrong. He's trying to express in hymnology and in poetry a verse. In fact, just three words found in the New Testament, which has no height or depth or length or breadth. It says this: God is love. There's a wideness in God's mercy that is wider than the sea. There is kindness in his justice, which is more than liberty. There's no place where all earth's sorrows are more keenly felt than heaven. There's no place where all earth's failings have such gracious judgment given. There is wonderful redemption through the blood that Jesus shed. There is joy for all the members in the sorrows of his head. For the love of God is broader than the measure of our minds, and the heart of the Eternal is most wonderfully kind. But we make His love too narrow by false limits of our own. We magnify His strictness with a zeal He will not own. If our love were but more simple, we should take Him at His word, and our lives would be illumined by the glory of the Lord. I tell you this, the more a man is filled with the Holy Spirit, the more a woman is filled with the Holy Spirit, the more of the mystery of the love of God shed abroad in our hearts becomes a reality. Oh, love of God, how deep, how wide, how incomprehensible, how infinite. Surely, when we get to heaven, remember, we shall worship a Lamb. Remember that it was said to this Lamb, "Behold, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world." Elihu, there's no love like the love of Jesus. Let's stand and sing.